Good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here and to be participating in the PPMD meeting. I think this is my sixth time participating, and I always enjoy seeing so many familiar faces and being part of such an inspiring and supportive community. So we're going to shift gears a little bit here in the sense that we're going to talk about biomarkers. And I think Sharon introduced the topic already as to the importance of having outcome measures for clinical trials. So if we're going to test these different drugs, it's very important that we have good biomarkers. So I'll be talking to you about our imaging DMD study. So this is essentially a multi-center study that includes multiple sites. So this is designed as an MR, a natural history study, whereby we focus on ambulatory boys ages 5 to 14. The MR data are collected at three different sites. That is, I'm trying to get my cursor here. That's Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. It's Oregon Health Science University, and then the University of Florida. So right now we have enrolled a total of 129 boys with Duchenne and 27 controls. The ages are, in terms of inclusion, are ages 5 to 14 years. And you'll see that the mean age of our boys with Duchenne is about 8 years of age. So in terms of the measurements, so all of the MR measurements are done in a 3T whole body magnet. We do not use sedation, and we don't use any contrast agents. The boys typically lay on their back inside of the magnet, and they watch a movie while we do the MR data collection. We have focused on both the lower leg muscles and on the thigh muscles. So in our study, we use a combination of both quantitative magnetic resonance imaging as well as spectroscopy. So most people are familiar with imaging, which provides a lot of detailed structural information on the muscles. And in this case, we also use spectroscopy, which is essentially a way to look at the underlying biochemistry of the muscle. And that's very important when we're looking at muscle quality. There are a number of potential advantages of using magnetic resonance. Obviously, an important one is that, in fact, that it's non-invasive. It does not use ionizing radiation. So it's a very safe method. And so if we're going to do clinical trials, I think it's very valuable to have something that you can easily implement in a longitudinal fashion. Obviously, MR is... It is an objective method, is not dependent on motivation. As you know, that can be sometimes challenging if a child has a good day or a bad day. That's not the case with MR. I think also important, and I think sometimes people don't realize that, is that you actually have a large sampling volume, and that's very important. When you take a muscle biopsy, so you're taking a biopsy from a very small amount of muscle tissue. With MR, not only can you look at the entire muscle, but you actually look at multiple muscles simultaneously. And as I'll show you later, you'll see that there's quite a bit of heterogeneity across muscles, so not all muscles look the same. And then finally, it is potentially a method that can be implemented in both boys that are ambulatory as well as boys that are non-ambulatory. So when we're developing biomarkers, there are some important criteria that MR will have to meet. The first one is that the measurements have to be robust. They have to be reproducible from one day to the next day, so that if you get a measurement today, ideally that measurement should be the same tomorrow, so that when you're looking at treatment effects or you're looking at disease progression, that that's a reliable number that you're looking at. Secondly, the measurement has to be sensitive, so it has to be sensitive to the disease progression or to changes in this trajectory of the disease progression. And then finally, it should be a meaningful measurement, meaning that it should relate to a functional measurement. And so another part that's important when we're talking about using MR as biomarker is that you really need to be able to have techniques that can be implemented across sites. And that can be challenging when you do complicated techniques. If you do the same measurement across sites, that can be really difficult. And so we've put a lot of effort into developing standardized operating procedures so that all of our sites, you get the same exact answer. And so you'll see as a consequence, to make that simple, we've really focused on more simple sequences and not the most sophisticated necessarily, but still very valuable. So one of the imaging techniques that we use is what's called a standard T1 weighted MR image. So in these type of images, the contrast on an image is defined by differences in the T1 relaxation of a tissue, and that's an inherent property. So on the left side here, you have a transaxial image. This is an image through the lower leg of a control healthy subject. And on the right side, you have a child with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So if we look at these lower leg muscles, then you can see that on these type of images, the subcutaneous fat, which is surrounding here the muscle, is bright. And if you look at inside of the muscle, the signal is quite homogeneous because the muscle fibers are kind of nicely structured next to each other, and so the signal looks homogeneous. If, on contrast, you look at the child with Duchenne, so we have here the bones, the tibia and the fibula, but when you look inside of that muscles, you can see that there's a lot more structure, that there's a lot of disorganization, and you have these very hyperintense regions. So the same thing is true when we now move over to the thigh muscles. Again, you can see on the left is a control healthy subject, and on the right, a child with Duchenne. And you can see these hyperintense regions inside of the muscle. And one of the things that I really want you to focus on is the level of heterogeneity that exists across the muscles. For instance, here you have a muscle, this is a gracilis, that appears to be much more preserved than the muscle that's right next to it. This is the biceps femoris, and you can see all that hyperintensity. The muscle is almost completely replaced by non-contractile material. So depending on where you would take a biopsy, you would have quite a different answer. So I think it's a very important point that sometimes is missed, that the muscle does not affect all muscles equally. We've already talked about differences in disease progression across boys, but that's also across muscles. So it's a very important point. So next I'm going to show you, these are snapshots of boys at different ages. So we have here, these are not the thigh muscles again. So you have here a child that's ages 5, and so you can see that you don't see a whole lot of these hyperintense regions. Okay, the muscle's pretty preserved. By the time the boys are here about 8 to 9, you can see here that you have these hyperintensity that's starting to show up. Here's a child that's age 10, 11, 12 to 13, and you can see the progression here once the boys hit the age of about 10 through 14. You can see that more and more muscles are replaced by non-contractile material. So measuring this non-contractile material could potentially be very important. We heard Sharon Hesterly talking today earlier about therapeutic strategies for muscle building. So having an ability to measure how much muscle is actually there and discriminating between what's really muscle and what's this non-contractile material can potentially be very valuable. So to quantify that, we can take advantage of what's called signal intensity thresholding. In a simple way, that just means what's bright is defined as non-contractile material, what's dark is defined as muscle. And so when we look at that here, quantitatively, you see that when the boys are younger than 8, there's actually not a whole lot of non-contractile material. But as the boys get older, you can see that each of these stages, you can see that there is an increase in this amount of non-contractile material. Again, some muscles are better preserved. Here is this gracilis muscle that I pointed out earlier, whereas the rectus femoris and these other muscles have about 60 to 80% replaced at the age of above 12, it is relatively well preserved when you're looking at the gracilis muscle. So we've been taking advantage of this T1 weighted images to look at some important questions. And one of the questions that we've started to look at is, how well does a 6-minute walk predict what the quality of the muscle is? So we know that a lot of the clinical trials are looking at potentially using as a 6-minute walk as an inclusion criteria. And that's important. The goal of that is really to look at the relatively homogeneous patient population, so having a narrow group of functions. But so here you have a 6-minute walk. These are boys that are pretty much in the same range. So that's ranging from 298 meters to 334. But when you look at their muscle quality, there's quite a bit of variability in this. So for instance, here you could see the two boys in the corner. When you look at their muscles, quite homogeneous, whereas for instance, kids here in the middle here, you can see that there's a lot more replacement by non-contractile material. So I should point out, these are now T1-weighted fat-suppressed images. So in these images, the fat or the non-contractile material looks dark. So wherever you see these dark regions, there is replacement by non-contractile material. The same thing is true when we look at these same boys here at the six-minute walk. You could see here again, these are now the thigh muscles. You could see that the two boys, one walks 312 meters, the other one 332. They appear to be more preserved than the boys, for instance, here, these four other boys. So the point that I'm trying to make is that the assumption that if everybody has the same walking distance in a six-minute walk, that doesn't mean that you know necessarily that they have the same exact muscle quality. And that, I think, might be important if we know that muscle is one of the is certainly the target. So that doesn't mean a six-minute walk isn't valuable, but I think it's important to consider that one doesn't necessarily mean the other. So the another imaging strategy that we have used is using a T2-weighted imaging. And this may particularly be valuable when we're looking at younger boys. So here we have a T1-weighted image, the same technique as I showed you earlier. This is T1-weighted with fat suppression. So when you look at these muscles, they look pretty homogeneous. And in fact, this is a five-year-old, and I'd be hard-pressed to tell you this is a child with Duchenne. This is a boy with Duchenne, but he looks pretty similar to a controlled healthy muscle on a T1-weighted image. Now, I'll show you what a T2-weighted image looks like. So here's the same child with a T2-weighted image, and you can see there is hyperintense regions here in the soleus. And when we combine that with fat suppression, you can see this is even more pronounced. So clearly you can see that this is a diseased muscle. So the T2-weighted imaging is a valuable imaging strategy, particularly in young boys. We heard Sharon explain earlier today that an important component of Duchenne is the fact that the muscle is very fragile. And so it's much more susceptible to muscle damage. And with that, associated with that muscle damage is an inflammation. So the value of T2 is that it has been used quite a bit in the literature to look at muscle damage. So clearly for Duchenne, this is potentially a very valuable measurement. T2 is a very sensitive method, and what's important about that is you can actually measure this inherent T2 property. And the way that you do that is by taking images at multiple echo times. So not only do you have an image, you can actually get a quantitative map now in which each of these pixels in an image tells you something very important, and that's what's shown over here. So if we now look at T2 in terms of this day-to-day variability and how robust it is, so you have here, these are T2 measurements done in the boys day to day. So typically we do an MRI on day one, and they come back and we do the same exact thing the next day, just to see how robust it is. And this is really important because if we're looking at a measure of muscle damage, you have to keep in mind that when we look at creatine kinase values, we know that there's quite a bit of variability. That doesn't seem to be the case when we're looking at muscle T2. So here we have for these different boys, we have here day one, day two, day one, day two, and you can see that for all of the boys and at all of the sites they will look at, that the measurements is quite robust. So if we look, for instance, at the coefficient of variance, the boys with DMD have 1.7%, which is pretty similar to the control boys. So we're quite happy with that, and we feel that it's a robust measurement. So next, we looked at how different are the boys with Duchenne compared to controls as a group. So here we have on the left side, this is the T2-weighted images, and you can see that the boys with Duchenne across all the muscles that we looked at have higher T2 values, so consistent with more muscle damage and inflammation. The same thing is true when we combine that technique with fat suppression, you have the same message. Next, we looked at the changes with age. What's important to know that if you take a healthy muscle, it has a very characteristic T2 that does not change with age. So these are the boys to control healthy subjects, and this is the 95% confidence intervals. So the T2 at a 3 Tesla is about 33 milliseconds in all of the boys. But then when you look at the children with Duchenne, you can see that even at the youngest age here, T2 is already elevated. And then you can see a progressive increase with age, with a more rapid increase in the thigh muscles, particularly the vastus lateralis, compared to the soleus, which is a calf muscle. So next we've started to look at whether MR can detect this anti-inflammatory effect associated with corticosteroids. We know that corticosteroids it has a therapeutic effect in the sense that it has extended the time of embolation, and some of this role is through its anti-inflammatory effect. So we did a simple comparison between the boys that were enrolled that were ages 5 to 7, of which half the group is on prednisolone and the deflazacort, and half of the boys are glucocorticosteroids naive. And we wanted to get a sense of whether T2 would be able to detect a difference between these two groups. And the answer is yes. So here we have the mean T2 values in orange for the boys that are glucocorticosteroid naive, and in blue the boys that are on glucocorticosteroids. And you can see that across all of the muscles that we looked at, the boys that were glucocorticosteroid naive had higher T2 values compared to the boys that were either on the deflazacort or prednisolone. The only muscle that did not seem to be the case is for the gracilis muscle. And remember, that's the muscle I told you earlier on was the more preserved muscle. But all other months, we clearly saw a difference between the boys on corticosteroids and the boys who were not on corticosteroids. So one of the next measurements that we focused on is measuring intramuscular fat. And we heard earlier that mice are not human. And I think when it comes down to intramuscular fat, that's actually an important distinction. Unlike the MDX mouse model, where there's relatively little fat inside of the muscle, in boys with Duchenne, that's a very big component of the disease progression. That as the muscle seems to have this diminished capacity to fix itself and repair itself, the muscle cells are ultimately replaced by more and more lipid cells. So trying to quantify this amount of intramuscular lipid, we think will be very important when we're looking at disease progression or strategies to try to change that trajectory of disease progression. So one way to do that is using MR spectroscopy. As I mentioned earlier, spectroscopy is a non-invasive biochemical sampling technique. It's considered the golden standard in MR community when you're trying to quantify biochemical compounds like fat or lipid. So here we have on the bottom, you have an image of a child with Duchenne together with the spectra. And so here you could see this signal here is what's lipid or what's fat. And on the left side here, you have water. On top, you have a child that's a healthy control, and you can see when you look at this lipid signal, that's much more pronounced in a child with Duchenne. So we can measure the fat fraction by looking at this ratio between lipid and water, and that's what I'll show you in the next slide here. So this is the lipid to lipid over water ratio, or what we call the fat fraction, at different ages. So this is measured in one of the thigh muscles. So here is a control healthy boy, ages 5 to 7, so here's the boys ages 5 to 7, 8 to 9, and then here 12 to 14. And you can clearly see that there's a progressive increase in the amount of intramuscular fat or this fat fraction inside of the muscles. We've also compared different muscles. So here we have the soleus muscle, which is one of the important calf muscles. You could see that when we looked at 50 subjects, 50 boys that we followed for 1 year, the average increase or change in 1 year was 20%, so 20% increase in this intramuscular fat over 1 year. And when we look at the thigh muscles, the vastus lateralis, you can see that's almost double that, about 40%. So much more rapid increase in this amount of intramuscular fat in the vastus lateralis compared to the soleus muscle. We've also looked at the effect of potentially corticosteroids. And in this case, we compared all of our boys with Duchenne that were on corticosteroids versus all of the boys that were not. So this was not just a 5 to 7-year-old group. It was across our entire cohort to just get a sense if we would see a difference. And so here you can see that for both of the muscles that we looked at, that's the soleus and for the vastus lateralis, you can see that there was a significant difference with a more rapid increase in the fat fraction in the boys that were not on corticosteroids or corticosteroid naive versus the boys that were on corticosteroids. Another technique that can be used and that we've implemented to look at this intramuscular fat, since it's such an important component of disease progression in the boys with Duchenne, is using Dixon imaging. So the advantage of this strategy is that you get actually an idea of the distribution of fat across the muscles, where at spectra you get a spectra and it's of a certain region. You have to define that on the front. Here you can actually look at the distribution of fat. And so here we have what's a water image on the left, and here you have on the right, you have a lipid image. So everything that's bright here is lipid or fat. And by putting these together, you can actually get a map of the fat fraction. And so this is a little bit of a complicated slide, but I wanted to walk you through this. So here we have these images are essentially fat maps of a, here's the lower leg of a child, and here is the thigh muscle of a child. And then here we looked at the relationship between the golden standard, which is spectroscopy, and then this Dixon fat fraction to see how well these two methods correlate, because ultimately there is advantages to knowing the spatial information as well. And so here these, in gray, you see all the values for all of the boys that we currently have in the study, and you can see overall there's quite a good relationship. And you can also see the variability in the amount of fat fraction. There's quite a range in the boys that we're looking at across the muscles and across the boys. And then I'm going to show you here over the next couple of slides the progression of one child. This is a child that was progressing quite rapidly, and we kind of caught him in this phase where we can see a rapid progression in disease. So I want you to look at here on the, we have the red is the soleus muscle, and then in here the triangle is at baseline, is the vastus lateralis. And then here you have the distribution of fat fractions across the entire muscle, okay? This is, again, the soleus, which is this muscle, and the vastus lateralis is this muscle. So this is at baseline, the same child here at 3 months, so you could see progression in this three-month window, and then here at 6 months. And what you'll see, too, is when you look at the distribution, you can see how that shifts. And then here at 1 year, and you can actually see this muscle is shifting really from having almost completely been replaced by this intramuscular lipid. I should point out, not every child progresses this fast, but this is just an example of a quickly progressing child in which you could see this rapid accumulation of intramuscular fat. As I pointed out earlier, it's really important that when we're developing biomarkers or outcome measures that they are reproducible, that you can trust the data, that from day to day you're going to get the same answer. So that if we're looking at the effect of a treatment, that we know that's a real effect and it's not just a noise. So we just recently published, for those people that are interested in radiology, we showed the reproducibility of all of the measurements that we've been developing together with the standard operating procedures. And you can see that across the different measurements that we do, that the day-to-day coefficient of variance ranges between 0.7 to 7.2%. So we feel quite confident that these measurements can be implemented in a reproducible way across multiple sites. We've also looked at the sensitivity to change over 1 year across different muscles. And so on the left side here, you have the standardized response mean for the lipid fractions. So the higher this number, the better. So here you could see that for both the soleus and vastus lateralis, this is quite good. When we looked at the T2, you could see that it depends on which muscle that you're looking at. Again, keeping in mind the variability across muscles. So the muscles in which we had the highest sensitivity was the biceps femoris, the peroneal, the vastus lateralis, and the soleus and medial gastrocnemius, so the calf muscles. The muscles in which we had the lowest was the gracilis. Remember, that's a muscle that doesn't seem to change a lot over time. So as a consequence, you will not see disease progression over that 1 year. The same thing is true for the tibialis anterior and tibialis posterior. So those are three muscles that show very little change over 1 year, whereas the other muscles show a lot more change. Finally, we've looked at the correlation between the MR measurements and function. And so we do a battery of functional tests. We do the 10-meter walk run. We do stair climbing, getting up from supine, and the 6-minute walk. And so here I just plotted as an example the relationship between the vastus lateralis MRT2 measure and the 10-meter walk. So first of all, you'll see that in black, these are the control healthy boys. They're kind of clustered together there because their T2 is lower than all of the boys with Duchenne. And then you can also see the correlation. There's a significant correlation between performance on the MR measurements in terms of T2 and the 10-meter walk run. We looked at all of our measures, and you'll see that all the baseline MRI, T2 measurements, and lipid fraction measures are significant to predict all four functional measures that we looked at. The best predictor seemed to be the vastus lateralis muscle in terms of both the lipids and the MRT2 measurements. So in conclusion, I think that there are potential advantages or strengths in using MR as a biomarker. The first one, I think, and the most important one, and certainly from a parent's perspective, is the fact that it's non-invasive. If we're going to do longitudinal studies, it's very hard to justify doing muscle biopsies repeatedly across, you know, over time. So I think if we could use MR as a non-invasive measurement, I think that would be very valuable. The measures are not dependent on effort. The data are quite objective. The quantitative muscle MR measurements, we feel that they're highly reproducible and they can be implemented in a reproducible way across sites. We've shown that the measures are sensitive to disease progression. T2 in particular already seems to be elevated in our youngest kids. So right now we're actually looking at going younger because in our five-year-olds the values are already very high. So we are looking at potentially going down to three-year-old boys with Duchenne. The MR measures seem to be related significantly with functional measures. And then finally, I think the fact that it can be implemented in both ambulatory and non-ambulatory boys provides potentially an opportunity to look at the wider age window when we're looking at clinical trials. So I just want to finish up with acknowledging all the people that have contributed to this work. There are some people that I would really like to recognize. Lee Sweeney has been very important in the development, Rick Finkel, Bill Rooney and Barry Russman at OHSU, at University of Florida, Glenn Walter, Barry Byrne, Donovan, Claudio is here today. And also a special thanks to all the families that traveled to our different sites. We couldn't do this study without you and really, really appreciate your contributions. And then our funding agency, the study is funded by NIMS and NNDS at NIH, muscular dystrophy, and then Parent Project has been very instrumental, and particularly early on when we were collecting pilot data, and we certainly appreciate their support. Thank you.